We learned how to compute the entanglement entropy for a system of harmonic oscillators that were coupled to each other, like in a two-dimensional net, for example, here, where we can think this as like a solid, and these are like the phonons in the solid, the degrees of freedom, vibrational degrees of freedom. And when we compute, as you were trying to see what happens in the continuum limit, we put more and more points inside this square, or what is the same, enlarging the square in the case that there is no scale in the theory. And the result was like this, was increasing like the perimeter of the square, and we also have a subleading term. If you subtract from here the area term, you get a logarithmic term. And we also made these other computations where you can draw different pictures, and you see that the area term is always proportional to the perimeter, so there is always a perimeter term. And the logarithmic term increases with a number of different points, and in fact, it was a sum over different vertices, and you can also play the game of drawing triangles or other pictures, and you get that this coefficient depends on the angle there. And we also rotated the square, and we saw that the area term changes, the coefficient changes, while the logarithmic term doesn't change. So from this, we got to the idea that there are some terms in the entropy that are well defined in the lattice, but in the continuum theory, if we want to obtain some results that do not depend on the regularization, these are not good terms. For example, the area term will depend on the details of the regularization. So we say that these terms are non-universal, while the coefficient of the logarithmic term is universal, does not depend on the regularization one can use. One can also do the calculation, analytic calculation of this term for this case of a free scalar field, and it coincides with the lattice calculation. You can do that also. So the idea is that then one can extract a general form of the entropy in quantum field theory. That would be something like this. Suppose you have the entropy of a region. In some dimension, then this will have some area term that let us call it G d minus 2 divided by epsilon d minus 2. D here is the space-time dimension, so this is the dimension of the surface. This is the boundary of the region. This is the dimension of the surface in any dimension. So this was the most divergent part. And then we have subleading terms that we can expand, for example, putting g d minus 3 etc. Some g0 that also depends on the boundary, log epsilon plus some constant term, S0 of the region, some term that does not scale with the cutoff. So this is a general structure that we expect from the theory, and we can understand this structure because the divergent pieces come always from ultraviolet degrees of freedom, short distance modes. And the short distance mode will produce entanglement across the boundary. So this is the reason why all these terms depend on the boundary. So if I have a feature like this, like the angle, it will produce a logarithmic term, but it will be something produced by locally by this, disregarding on how the shape of the rest of the set. So we have these divergent pieces that are always So what can we say about this expression? This expression have divergent terms. And we can say that the divergent terms, we can think that the divergent terms are independent of the state, first of all, because they are produced by very high energy excitations that do not see the state only. They will be the same for any state and the vacuum, so independent of the state. These are also local in the boundary. And as the high energy degrees of freedom across this point and the high energy degrees of freedom across this point do not talk to each other, and the entropy is extensive quantity for things that are like tensor products that do not talk to each other, we can say that these terms are also extensive on the boundary. Extensive means that in general we expect that this coefficient here is some integral along the boundary. For example, and of course you have to match the dimensions in order that the dimension of the entropy is zero. So typically this will grow like something like R or some scale, R to the d minus 2, so it will be something related to the area. But of course these terms are not universal in general. Yeah, well, you expect that this all these abelian terms are locals of some integrals, and this is related to what Rob Myers was talking yesterday, that if you have, if you have a nice cutoff that is geometrical, then you expect that these terms will be given by some geometrical things on the boundary, for example, integrals of curvature of the boundary, if you have a smooth boundary. So, for example, in that case, this term will not appear in general because you have to put two dimensions less in order to get the right dimension, putting some integral of the curvature. Here the area will be the integral of just one, some number, and the next two leading will be the integral of some curvature of the surface. But in general, if you take any cutoff, for example, in the lattice, you will get these terms, and you can also get something more bizarre with fractional powers depending on the theory on your specific regularization. So these terms from the point of view of quantum field theory do not have any information of the theory itself, but they are like artifacts of the regularization. Of course, this applies for all divergent pieces except for the logarithmic term, where if you change the cutoff, you will get something different, but the divergent piece will have the same coefficient. So G0 is universal, but it's also an integral over the boundary. So for example, in four dimensions, it will be given by some coefficient that is known that is an anomaly, something belonging to the theory, times integrals of the curvature along the surface, if you have a smooth surface. but, okay, so one can say, well, then the entropy, the only information universal that has is in here, the G0 coefficient, but it's not correct to say that because we have this term here. The finite piece, one can think it has a lot of information. For example, if you have a thermal state, you know that this S0 will go like the volume times some entropy density. Uh, For example, this will be t to the d minus 1, and some coefficient here. So in a massless theory, will be t to the d, temperature to the d minus 1. So in principle, the usual thermodynamic entropy will be inside this finite term here. There is also, for example, for fermionic systems, if you go to the zero temperature and you have a chemical potential, you have a Fermi surface, this is zero, it scales like Carl Boltzmann, Carl Fermi surface times volume, sorry, the area, so it's kr minus 2 log. So it has this strange, it's a correction, it's like an area but corrected logarithmically. So you can extract some information, for example, the size of the Fermi surface from the entropy. And there are many other things that you can get, even in vacuum, from the constant term here. But the question then is how to obtain a number for this, how to obtain the universal part of this, because as you can change the cutoff here, then it could be the case that this put some rubbish on this S0, so you have to extract a universal part that does not depend on the cutoff. So you have to do it carefully. In general, one can argue that, for example, with sufficiently geometrical regularization, this term will be protected against the problems coming from the cutoff. But if we want to have a prescription where we can do that, even in the lattice, for example, where you have this type of regularization that is breaks rotational symmetry, breaks translational symmetry, etc. So if you are aiming to something that is completely independent of the detailed regularization, there must be a way to extract this, the universal piece. And a way to do that is not just considering one region, but suppose you have now two regions. A, B. So we can produce this quantity. A union B. And why we make this combination? Because in this combination, we know that all these divergent pieces are local on the boundary. So if I take the entropy of A, the divergent piece will be something here, but the same contribution will appear in the union, and it will appear in the union the divergent contribution of this plus the divergent contribution of this. So this thing is called the mutual information between these two regions, and it's completely finite in the continuum limit. So this is really what quantum field theory is telling us, that is the well-defined quantity. If they intersect, in general, you expect to have some problems, because suppose so in this case you are not you would aim to this thing S A plus S B minus S A union B, but then you have this region here, so this in A union B, is only the boundary is only this, right? So these pieces of the boundary are not subtracted here. So I will put here something like minus S A intersection B that has also the boundary here. But then the problem is that in A and B, we do not have any angles, for example, in this picture. But we have angles in A intersection B and in A union B. And these angles will give you some logarithmic term, for example, in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So this quantity is not finite, even if you subtract the area terms. The area terms will disappear, yes. Yeah, this G0, you say? This G0 is universal. In 2 plus 1 dimensions is, but you, for a smooth surface, you don't get any logarithmic term. Because in that case, it will be given by some integral of the curvature that doesn't have the dimensions to be, because this has to be dimensionless. No, it's universal, but it appears only when you have angles in the boundary. There's not. Okay, if you have this logarithmic term, then it will produce something here that is not universal, because if you change this by 2, then you have a logarithm of 2 here. But with mutual information, you can also have, it doesn't matter. That with mutual information, this term will be, if you change the cutoff by 2, it will also change. For example, if you have something like this, 2 squares. So there will be some logarithmic term from here, but it will also appear in the union of the two regions, so it will cancel, right? So this quantity is always well defined in quantum field theory, but you have to take the two regions that are separated. They cannot touch. So let me show some. Can we change here to the slides? Okay. So this is an example. Suppose you have a square lattice in 2 dimensions. You draw a circle now. You want to compute the entropy of circles. Then it's a very bad choice, the square lattice for circles, right? But you can insist. I have my theory. I want to define it going to the continuum limit in any way, and I should get always the same thing because I'm aiming to something that is universal. So the circle can be studied also in the square lattice. And then what you get is something like this. As you increase the size of the circle, you get something linear. Okay, it has an area term. And then you subtract the area term. You expect the circle has something like this. Some area term plus some constant term. There is no logarithmic term. So you subtract the area term here. And what you get is this that is always like noisy as you increase the size of the circle. Because sometimes it gets 1 point more, sometimes 1 less, because of the square lattice is not well. It doesn't play well with the circle. but then if you take, for example, 2 circles and then dilatate, for example, here is one, this is the size of the circle. Of course, you have to keep, as you dilatate, you have to keep the ratio of the sizes of the distance and the radius of the circles constant in order that you get to some definite geometry in the continuum limit. In that case, what you get is something like this. The mutual information is also like noisy in the lattice, but it smoothly goes to something constant, some number that you can see here is a number between 0.5 and 0.54. So it's a this is another thing that these numbers are very small. If you compare this number with log 2 is just one bit of information. It's very small. So it means that, in general, you expect that this mutual information is, for example, in this case, is 1/10 of a bit in infinitely many degrees of freedom. These regions have infinitely many degrees of freedom. So why is very small? It's very small because in the quantum field theory, it's very local. So in the vacuum state, this is in the vacuum state, you don't see much entanglement at large distances. Of course, you can put some excited state with a lot of EPR pairs from here and here, and then it gets bigger, right? But in the vacuum, it's a very small number. But so let me say a few things about the mutual information. For this, I will say a bit some things about the properties of the entropy. Yes, it's again, free scalar, yeah. Well, this is interesting. For the free scalar, we can compute numerically the entropies, but we do not expect in this regard. Of course, the universal terms will be different, but all the structure of the entropy will be similar. So, for example, if you have a few degrees of freedom, mutual information will be for some distance compared to the sizes of order one. It will be some number of order one. Okay, I will show some different example. The first property is additivity. Additivity means that if you have a state that is a product state of two states in different regions or different Hilbert spaces, the entropy of AB, of the union of AB, will be just the sum. This is, of course, due to the logarithm, and is somehow a defining property of the entropy, because we want that the entropy of things that do not talk to each other is just the sum of them. And this is the reason why the entropy has a logarithm inside. You can go to subadditivity. Subadditivity means that if the state is not like this, it has some, it's not a product, you have that entropy of AB will be less or equal to the entropy in A plus the entropy on B. You can think the typical case where you have entanglement. So, for example, the state in AB will be pure, and this will be zero, while the states in the reduced spaces is some positive number. This already tells that the mutual information is always positive. And then you have this other property called strong subadditivity that we have heard about in the lecture by Juan yesterday. If you have, let's say, two regions like this, then this means that the entropy in A plus the entropy in B is literally equal to the entropy in A intersection B plus the entropy in A union B. And from here, you can see that the mutual information is always increasing. So if I have region A, region B, and let's say C, it will be smoothly increasing. What I put here, I. So it's, the mutual information is increasing. So, and we also have this other thing that is, suppose now that the, you have a region and you want to extract the entropy. We know that the mutual information is well defined and we want to extract the entropy of this region using mutual information. So somehow to obtain the simpler idea of an entropy, we depend only on one region, while mutual information depends on two regions. Then what one can do is take some now well-defined distant regularization with some distant epsilon and take as B all the part that is outside. This is, I call B. So mutual information in this case, heuristically, will go to SA plus SB minus SA union B. So this thing, if you think that the state is pure, we have already seen that the entropy of a region is exactly the same as the entropy of the outside part. So you can think that the entropy of B will be going to the entropy of A. And the entropy of the union, if this cutoff, let's say, crosses, let's say, the last distance in the lattice, then there will be nothing here. So the A union B will be the full space, and then this thing will be zero. So in this limit, one expects, of course, this is heuristic because there are the divergences, but one expects that this behaves like 2SA, twice the entropy. So one can think that this, this mutual information is a kind of regularization of the entropy that is well-defined, all the terms. So one expects that mutual information in this limit behave exactly as the entropy, but where all the terms here, all the terms are well defined now. It depends exactly on what you put as epsilon. So let me show an example where we can, another thing that so what one can say, well, what kind of information can I get from the mutual information, for example, for some theory? And then it's known that, so in principle, one expects, for example, some coefficient, some area term, for example, this area term with some coefficient that is well-defined in the limit of a small distances. So let's say EA, with some epsilon will go, the first term will go like area over epsilon to the d minus 2 with some coefficient that is well defined, plus. So it will be divergent when these things touch each other because there is a lot of shared information. This mutual information is like measuring the shared information between A and B because, again, there are many high energy degrees of freedom. And what happens when the two things are very far separated? Then when there is a calculation by Cardi, ...2013, that tells that the mutual information, in this case, will go like the some correlator of the field of some fields that square, where these are the you have to take the correlator of the fields that go to zero, correlators go to zero in quantum field theory for large distances, the one that goes to zero slowly, more slowly, and for example. So I will show an example of this. For example, let us think in a theory that is a scalar. Massless in 2 plus 1 dimension. So in this case, the mutual information will go like this, this correlator square, and it goes like one over L square. And you can also think that there is, you can also compute this. You can compute in the lattice because it's a free scalar field. And let us also think in a free Maxwell field. In 2 + 1 dimensions. And in this case, mutual information will go like the correlator of F mu nu square, which behaves like 1 over x L times to the 6th power. But this is interesting also because it's known that there is a duality between these two fields. The duality writes as, in this way, F mu nu is equal to 1/2 So what this means is that any correlation function of the F mu nu field, so this F mu nu has is just a way of writing the electric field and the magnetic field. So it means that all correlation functions are equal for the electric and magnetic fields and the derivatives of the scalar field. But of course, these two theories, the scalar field and the Maxwell field in three dimensions, are not exactly equal because the Maxwell field only has this electric and magnetic field, while the scalar field has also the field phi. And here we only see a mapping from the derivatives of one to each other. So from the fact that the mutual information increases with the algebra of operators, we can see that mutual information of the gauge field always has to be less or equal to the mutual information of the scalar in 2 + 1 for massless scalar, right? Yeah. For a gap theory, you will have something like this, and this is exponential. You can plug there the exponential, and this is the way it goes to zero, the mutual information. For this inequality, here, any two regions that are fixed, but you take the limit of large distance going to infinity. Of course, you know that it goes with this power of the correlator, but the coefficient in front is very difficult to compute, and it can be computed, for example, for a sphere or something like that, but in general, it's a tough calculation. So let us see how this So this is example. There you have a. This is a mutual information of two squares. You can write it in terms of the ratio between the size of the square and the length that separates the squares, because it's a conformal theory, so there are no scales, so it has to be mutual information that doesn't have dimensions. It has to be a function of the ratio. And you can take the limit for any ratio, the limit of the continuum limit, and you get this is a log-log plot of the mutual information between in terms of this ratio. And what you get is that this is the scalar, and this is the Maxwell field. And you get exactly this power law behavior here for the Maxwell field and the scalar. And for short distances, when the two squares are very near to each other, you expect to have this area dependence there. So this epsilon there will be given by this L. This is the size of distance. So you expect a particular power law behavior here that is also much. And in fact, they go with the same coefficient. This coefficient will be the same because most of the high energy degrees of freedom are related to the derivative of the field, not just the field. So you expect a matching of the coefficients. Sorry, again, please. Yeah, well, yeah, this calculation that I showed before, so this one. This one corresponds to just one point here, one of these points, because you have to fix the ratio between R and L and go to the continuum limit, so you get one point there. And then you change the ratio, and you also go to the continuum limit, and you get another point. And this is the way this plot is done. Yeah, for a conformal theory, it's the operator that has the lowest dimension, conformal dimension. But you also have to, this operator have to, the two operators that enter into the correlator have to have this, of course, non-zero vacuum expectation value. Right? Okay. So, okay, let us continue then. This is a... This inequality should hold for any regions. For any regions. Well, it's not exactly the same that what I said here is that if you use this inequality, you get that the mutual information is always increasing with size of the region, right? But you can also see that it increases with the size of the algebra of operators. So the algebra of operators of the Maxwell field is given by the algebra of operators of the derivatives of the scalar. But you also have this other field that is not in the algebra of G mu nu, or sorry, in the algebra of the A mu and the algebra of the gauge field. So the algebra of the scalar field is always bigger, and you get always like this inequality. Yeah, this field is not in the Maxwell. Okay, then the mutual information describes all the. So of course, with the mutual information, you can also reproduce the logarithmic terms. If you, for example, if you have this thing like this. You have a logarithmic term coming from the vertex, and you can do this trick of computing the mutual information, and you will get this logarithmic term there. So all the information is in the mutual information. Of course, in many practical calculations, we want to compute only the entropy because mutual information is more complicated. It has two regions. But we have to keep in mind that we have the right tool to answer questions when we have doubts about if this term is or not universal in the entropy. So let me move on to some application of entanglement entropy in quantum field theory. This application is about the C theorems. Well, this what is a C theorem? Let us think, for example, you have a quantum field theory. Now I'm thinking only in vacuum state. So you have a quantum field theory, and you have a small distant behavior theory and the large distant behavior. So, for example, for the standard model, you would have at short distances, there are a lot of particles, the quarks, and all particles that are massive turn to be, you can think in the, at short distance behave like as massless particles. So you can think for very short distances, your theory behaves as if there is no scale, because all masses do not matter for short distance correlators. you can think for short distances, you have a theory without scales, what we call a conformal theory. And for very large distances, all fields that are massive are decoupled already. For example, for the standard model, it will be that you only have the Maxwell field. All the other got massive already. So for very short energy, very small energies, you only can excite with only very small energy, you can only excite photons. So the idea is to So this one? Yeah, yeah, this one. Okay. No, this is, for example, suppose you have this is the boundary, and you have some interval here, and then this is the bulk. Then this the entropy will be given by the area of this minimal surface here, and then you want to compute the entropy of what is outside. This is B, this is A, with some epsilon here, and then the entropy of all this will be given by the area of this minimal surface here, and then you have to subtract the entropy of A union B. A union B is all this plus all what is outside, so it's exactly the same as the entropy of these two intervals. So it's something like this. This is the minimal surface. So then you put here a cutoff, distant cutoff from the boundary, and then you can see that all divergent pieces cancel because they go in the same way to the boundary here. So somehow in the holographic case, you get that the epsilon in the entropy, the divergent piece, is replaced by your new epsilon that is a geometrical quantity. So holographic regularization is very good regularization, and one can in principle compute from the entropy many things that are universal, for example, mutual information or something like that. So one can think what would be the relation between the ultraviolet degrees of freedom in this small short distance scale and the infrared degrees of freedom at large distance scale. And if you have some fields that become massive, we can say, well, they are decoupled, so somehow the degrees of freedom at the infrared will be less than the degrees of freedom at the ultraviolet. This idea is what is called C theorem, but in fact it's not the result of the C theorem is not in fact measuring the degrees of freedom exactly. For example, if you think, of course, degrees of freedom are in the quantum field theory are infinite, both in any scale are always infinity. So we have to see what is the quantity that is measuring this irreversibility of the normalization group. You can think of this changing of scale from small to large is like going through along the normalization group from ultraviolet to the infrared. And you want a measure of how degrees of freedom decouple somehow. So if you want something that you can compare the theories without a scale at short and large distances, it has to be something that first belongs to the theory itself, so it's a, It's a well-defined randomized quantity. And second, it has to be something dimensionless, because the theories in the at the fixed points, this small distance scale or large distance scale, do not have any dimension. So the idea is that there is a quantity C that is dimensionless and well-defined. And we want that this quantity is is decreasing from short to long distances. So let us think in 1+1 dimensions, two-dimensional space-time. There is a theorem. The first theorem was proved by Samologico. But his proof is using some properties of correlators of a stress tensor traces for the stress tensor, and the quantity that he got is something like this: is this C of some distance, let's say R, is equal to the integral infinity R this is the function that interpolates for short distances. You get the integral from 0 to infinity here, plus this constant. And for R infinity, you get this quantity that is infrared. And this C infrared and the C ultraviolet that you get as there is a number here. That you get from integrating over all the space, these are traces of a stress tensor, can be is called these are called central charge, because at the fixed points in the theory in two dimensions that doesn't have a scale have a symmetry that is a conformal symmetry, and these numbers are well defined in the algebra of these conformal theories, and in particular, for example, appear in many formulas for this theory. For example, in the entropy density in a thermal state, you get the same number. So these are well-known numbers for these conformal theories, and it tells you that this number decreases along the normalization group from the ultraviolet fixed point to the infrared. So let us try to show this theorem in using entanglement entropy. First of all, we have to understand what we expect for the entropy of a two-dimensional theory. Suppose you have a theory that is massive, that there is no long distance excitations, so it's gap, and then you have an interval in 1+1 dimension. So how does this the entanglement entropy of this interval look like? And you can see that entanglement will be produced across this boundary and across this boundary, but these boundaries will not talk to each other because long distance correlators are exponentially suppressed. So this means that as you increase the size of the interval, you get the same contribution from the boundaries and nothing else. So it means that the entropy for a gap system will go as some constant. It will saturate. You expect something like this, as was in the lecture of Vidal yesterday, that the entropy in terms of R will grow somehow and then saturate. If you have instead a gapless system, a conformal theory, then you have a let's say excitation modes with some length wavelength, and you have excitation with higher wavelength, with higher wavelength, etc. And the theory looks like in all these cases the same. And then at some point, this excitation will have a wavelength much bigger than this size, so it will not notice that you are like tracing out this interval. So it will not give you any new. Somehow this wavelength you cannot reduce to this interval. So you expect that the entropy will be given by some constant, the integral over the different wavelengths between some small scale that we call epsilon here, that is an ultraviolet cutoff we are putting, and some distance here that we put R. R is the size of the interval. But of course, this is not. You have to put, this is not, this has some dimensions. You have to put lambda here in order that the measure that you are measuring the different modes is a scale invariant. And from this formula, you get that this is constant log R over epsilon. So you expect this type of behavior, and in fact, for a gapless system, a gapless system, you can see and you can compute this number. I'm not showing this computation here, but perhaps the next talk. This number is equal to the C over 3, where this C is the same that appears in the homological theorem, and this is this central charge that belongs to the theory and appears in many formulas of these theories. So this is what we expect for a massless theory, and this is what we expect for a massive theory. And we can also obtain what is this constant here, or how does it behave with the mass from just this formula. Suppose that you have this formula for very small intervals, because the masses do not count. So it looks like this. This is a log. And then for very large distance, it's a constant. But in any distance, the epsilon, the behavior in epsilon, is something that comes from the boundary. So we cannot change the behavior in epsilon, the way it goes with epsilon. So the entropy for very large distances, for, let's say, R, M, much greater than 1, will be proportional to some constant that it has to have the same behavior in epsilon. Like this. I take it from here. It has to have the same behavior in epsilon. So, but then this formula doesn't have the, it has some logarithmic units that we have to kill. So the only parameter that enters is some mass. And we know, of course, that there will be some other constant here. But the behavior of how it changes with mass, it must be this way. So this is for a completely gapped system. But suppose now that we have a theory. Oh, OK. But suppose now we have a system that for large distances you have already lost some degrees of freedom, but still you have some massless degrees of freedom. So what do you expect in that case? In the ultraviolet, you expect that the theory, the entropy goes like C over 3. Let's call it, no? Okay. It was here. So we expect then that the entropy of R for Rm much less than 1 will go like C ultraviolet, let's say. This is the C of the theory in, for short distances, log R over epsilon. And for large distances, you expect that Sr will be given for this is for Rm much greater than 1, like C infrared now. And of course, we have to say that the behavior in epsilon is always the same. So this should be accompanied with a quantity that is C ultraviolet minus C infrared over 3. Log 1 over epsilon, and here we have to put some mass scale. So this is the behavior in the two limits for very short distance and for very large distance. But in the middle, it can be, you have to interpolate between these two things, and the entropy will grow like logarithmic here, something, and some logarithm for large distance that has a different coefficient from this one. And the idea is to understand at least something on how, some constraints on how this interpolation can take place here. So we are going to use a strong subadditivity to see some constraint on that. But let me first do some previous remarks on what we expect of the entropy in vacuum for a generic region that now doesn't live only on a single time slice, but it can be slanted, let's say, in space-time. So this is time, this is x. So we have seen, we have talked about the entropies of some region in a fixed time. In quantum field theory, relativistic quantum field theory, one usually uses the Heisenberg representation. Let's say the state is completely fixed at all times, and then the fields depends on x and t. So I have a field here, different operators. So if you compute the entropy here, and then you can think, well, what about if I want to compute the entropy not here, but in another like a slice like this of a space time, so another Cauchy surface. So you can think, well, what is the entropy of this interval? Is the entropy in some given states of the algebra of operators there, or some subset of the Hilbert space, some factor of the Hilbert space, where these algebra of operators act. And then you can say, well, I have another algebra of operator here, but the operator, for example, an operator here, because of the equation of motion, will be expressed by some, perhaps if it's not interacting, very complicated, in a very complicated way in terms of the operator here, because of causal evolution. So in fact, the algebra of these two things, the operators that live here and the operators that live here, is exactly the same. There is a a mapping of algebras. So we expect that the entropy does not depend on where you put your slice. In fact, you can say that the entropy is a function of the equivalence class of these surfaces that can be drawn like this. It's like a diamond. It's what is called the the causal development of the initial interval. So the entropy is something that is attached to these diamonds. And this holds for any state. It's not just a vacuum. For any state, it's the same. You can say in another way that it perhaps is more transparent, that you can say, well, how do I compute the entropy? I take some surface that goes through all the space-time, and I trace over the degrees of freedom in this part for the state that is a fixed state because we are in a Heisenberg representation. So for any of these surfaces, you see that you trace the same state over the same degrees of freedom in the same surface. So it's the same thing, right? Well, this is the first commentary I want to do. So, and the second is how you apply strong subadditivity in this space-time situation. So strong subadditivity is SA plus SB greater or equal than SA union B plus SA intersection B. But if you go to a book where this property is proved, that is complicated proof, what is behind the proof is that you split your Hilbert space in the product of three Hilbert spaces. So you need three Hilbert spaces. Let's say this is A intersection B, and this is B1. So you expect that your Hilbert space AB, complete the Hilbert space, is the tensor product of HA1 But now, if you have a tensor product of Hilbert spaces, an operator acting on this will commute with any operator acting on the other. So suppose you have HA times HB. An operator acting on this will read like operator on A times 1B. And an operator acting on this will look like 1A OB. So the commutator of these two things, you can easily see, is zero. So these ideas are related, tensor product of Hilbert spaces and operators acting on this Hilbert spaces that commute to each other. So if you come back to this situation, we see that the operators acting on this have to commute in order to apply strong subadditivity with all this and with all the operators here. So, and this is the typical situation in quantum field theory where these regions are space-like separated because some property is called microcausality that simply tells that you cannot send signals from one region to some other region that is space-like separated. So if I take in space-time, for example, in 2+1 dimension, and you can think this is a spatial surface that is slanted in space-time, and you can take another one. In order to apply strong subadditivity, the only thing that I have to ensure is that these two surfaces can be put in the same spatial surface, the same Cauchy surface of the space-time. It means that these have to intersect also. If they do not intersect, one is to the, let's say, time future of the other, then you cannot apply strong subadditivity. So then let us apply this in 1+1 dimension for intervals. The simplest situation let us take a diamond And let us think this is A, and this is B. We are able to think in these sets because these are spatial. You see that this when this interval is gets to here is null, and then a time-like interval will be there. And so let us name. So if I want to apply the strong superadditivity to this, I have to think applying strong superadditivity in some spatial slice that passes through the boundaries of all these regions. So I will take this one. Perhaps this is in color. So I will use this surface to apply strong superadditivity. So I will call this A1, this A intersection B, or let me call X first to this one and this B1. So it's divided in three pieces. And then I can use a strong superadditivity S A1 X plus S X B1 is greater or equal than the intersection is just X plus S A1 X B1. But the next step is to realize that A1 X is the same thing as A because it's a different Cauchy surface for the same region. So SA1X is equal to SA, and the same for B1X. Of B. And then we have this other set that is A1X B1, and this is equivalent to this other region here. Let me call it Y. So S A1 X B1 is equal to S Y. But then now we are thinking in vacuum state, in vacuum state in the quantum field theory. So these entropies do not depend on boost. So it has to be something as a, which is a function of the length. Of the length of these intervals. So xy will be some function of the length of y, xb will be some function of the length of b, etc. Let me call this the size of this interval a and the size of this interval b. So what we have is that is this inequality is translated, of course, into sa plus sb. Greater or equal to Sx plus Sy. And then we can translate also this in terms of the entropy as a function of distances, Sa plus Sb, greater or equal than Sx, let's say, plus Sy. But now we are in Minkowski space, and there is a relation that you can work out easily between. This is like a trapezoid, and there is a relation between the sizes of this interval that is that A times B is equal to X times Y. This is just geometry. And then you can take, for example, the case, the simplest case that will be that the size of A and the size of B are equal. So let us take A equal to B. And then from this formula, we get that this is equal to the square root of xy. X, the small interval, and the large interval. And so we get this relation that S square root of xy. These are distances now, twice. is greater or equal than Sx plus Sy. And then we can just, in order to get some more simple information from this inequality, we can say, well, let us take x and y very similar. So y have to be greater than x. And we take y equal to x plus some delta, which is very small. And then it just Taylor expand this formula and see what we get. And what we get from there is that S prime of X times X prime, which is equal to S prime of X plus X S second derivative of X, is greater than zero. So it's smaller than zero. So let us call then this quantity here C of X. C entropic, let's say, of X is X S prime of X. Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry. And then, well, finally, what we get is that this quantity, say C of E prime, is negative. So it decreases with size. But on the other hand, is something that is universal, because now the logarithm of epsilon, the constant term divergent piece, will be eliminated by the derivative. So this quantity is well defined, and in fact, you can see that this quantity, from the fact that you can expand from short and large distances in terms of this logarithm, this derivative times x converts this logarithm in just a constant. So what we get is that c is equal to C infrared, C ultraviolet over 3 for X matches XM, let's say, much smaller than 1, and CE X, XM much greater than 1 is equal to C infrared over 3. So we get the same result as the Samolodchikov theorem using this property of entanglement entropy. The function itself on how it goes with the size is very different from some logical function, but at the endpoints it coincides with the some logical result. Okay.